Vous écoutez Résonance FM 104.4, l'art d'écouter le bruissement de l'ombre.
This is the Bike Snob of New York City, and you're listening to The Bike Show on Resonance FM 104.4.
Welcome to The Bike Show here on Resonance FM. You join us on the longest day of the year, June the 21st, the summer solstice, in Bethnal Green, East London, but not for much longer, as we're heading out for what Grant Peterson refers to as a sub 24-hour overnight camping trip. It's about 8 o'clock in the evening and we're leaving town now to go and find a place to camp and spend the night. And when I say we, I'm joined by Dixie Wills, cyclist, author, humorist. It's humorist, it's a terrible word, isn't it? Yeah. Humorist.
There's no pressure to be funny now at all, that's the great thing.
And Simon Jones, editor and cyclist. And we're going to be following Dixie because he is the man to go to if you want to go camping on these shores. You write for The Guardian and you've just recently had a book about tiny campsites published, which is doing very well.
Yes, it is, of which I'm very pleased, in fact. So my camping days are over. I'm buying a small island and building a mansion on it. There you go. No pressure to be humorous at all.
Where are we going?
Today, Matthew, we're going to be cycling about half a mile from where I live, and we're going to get onto the Regent's Canal very briefly. We're going to whip over onto the Hertford Cut, and then we're going to cycle up the Lee Valley out of London.
Fantastic. Let's go. It's not been a mile since we left Bethnal Green. We are within sight of the Olympic Stadium, just off the Hertford Cut, but we've befallen two incidents, the first of which was something that I've expected to happen many times, cycling down one of the very steep slopes that the footpath takes after it's gone over a bridge. And Dixie, you almost ended up
in the drink. Yes, terribly exciting moment there. Front wheel, bit of plastic. I thought it was just going to roll over. It didn't really look at it. But no, the plastic slid under my front wheel. My life passed before me, but thankfully I was going quite slowly, so I was able to hold it in.
Any grazing or chafing to the organism?
No.
The organism is intact.
The organism, happily, is entirely intact. No, more shaken than hurt, I think, probably.
Unlike Simon's rear wheel, which has suffered a puncture just now, which is the second of the unfortunate incidents to afflict our small party of three, and he's now disengaging the hub gear of his rather smart bicycle, and obviously the inner tube, the spare inner tube, is at the very bottom of his pannier because all his camping gear is splayed out over the pavement, awaiting the attentions of the local Fish Island hoodlums. Actually, they're not hoodlums on Fish Island, they're very nice people, and there's those warehouses over there is full of all kinds of people, from graphic designers to circus performers. I've met some of them.
Not a hoodlum among them, I would imagine.
A lot of people say, oh, I like to ride a bike, but I can't because of my job, because I've got to travel around for my job. Now, you have a job, which is writing travel books, visiting every corner of the country, whether it's writing about tiny islands that you want to buy or campsites that you'd like to spend the night in. And that would strike a lot of people as the obvious job where you, oh, I'd love to have a bicycle, but I've got to do it by car. But you do all your research for your books by bike and bus and train.
Mainly train and bike. Yeah, just take my bike on the train, get to wherever I need to go, and then cycle around the area on a bike.
Is that making life hard for yourself, or is that helpful in terms of writing the books?
Well, it started out as a kind of a vaguely eco option, but also the fact that I didn't have any money, and that's a very cheap way of doing a lot of research. But it's come to be so ingrained in me now that I don't actually think of any other way of doing anything. And I just love it, because you take the train to wherever you're going, that's usually quite nice. If it's a journey of several hours or whatever, you can look out the window, see where you're going. So you get an idea of crossing the country to where you're going. And then you slow down even more when you're cycling around. So you're pootling around, I don't know, 10, 12 miles an hour, not very fast. And you actually get to see where you are, as opposed to driving around in a car where you're just flashing through things and arriving at a destination. On a bike, I feel, you know, the journey is all.
But do you get any pressure from editors and commissioning editors and the features desk to say, you know, you don't need 2 weeks to do this bit of research? Get in the car. Do it in 2 days.
Weirdly, they're pretty supportive. I think they know I'm fairly stubborn on this one. I'm not going to give in. So they probably roll their eyes, then phone me up and say, yeah, this is going to take you longer than we would do it in. And I say, yep. But having said that, it is again quite an efficient way of doing it. If you go by train, you get somewhere quite quickly, and so it doesn't matter particularly if you take a bit more time cycling around.
So do you have any sympathy for anyone who says, I'd love to bike everywhere, but my work means I've got to have a car?
Well, you know, I don't have sympathy for them. I do have pity, perhaps. I just think if you try and think outside of the car, so to speak, if you try and think of ways of doing things without a car, very often you can find a way of doing it. It may mean that you take a bit longer, or it may mean that your journey is slightly more complicated than it would be just throwing stuff in a car and roaring off. But I think ultimately it's a lot more satisfying, and with petrol prices as they are, it's an awful lot cheaper.
And so on your bike here, we've got the bike, lovely mid blue, what is it?
It's a Falcon Oxford.
Oxford, with a couple of large black panniers on the back. Is that you? So you've got your standard kit there. Obviously, we're just going away for a night, but you still need to carry quite a lot just for a night, don't you? But do you have it all sort of, are you pretty finely tuned, finely honed camping machine that, you know, you don't have to run around like I do, going, oh, where the hell is that bloody spork or whatever?
It's all in a great big box in a cupboard. Yeah, I open the box, it's all there, I throw it in. Yeah, I'm pretty much there. Although having said that, I'm always adding little bits of equipment, little gizmos, and I think, oh yes, don't forget to take that. That's in the blue plastic bag or whatever. So I'm not quite a machine. But, yeah, I do have it sort of up and running. I can, you know, if you rang me up, I'd probably be ready in 10 minutes kind of thing.
I've got a bar of chocolate in my pocket, and we could offer Simon a couple of cubes or something.
Like,
see if that will improve his morale as he's fixing his puncture. Let's wander down there. So what's happened here? Has this thing spun around?
Yeah, I've got no idea.
Because that look, there's a huge gaping hole.
That shouldn't,
Is something actually snapped or broken?
Could well be.
Where's bicycle repairman when you need him?
If it goes.
There's a very sort of mashed up bit of plastic. Yeah, does that.
I don't think we're going to get it fixed now. If we can get it running as a fixed gear for now.
Okay.
Then I'll take it in somewhere tomorrow.
Just past a very tempting looking Anchor and Hope pub.
Anchor and Hope, yeah.
And Dixie said, no, we must press on. I thought maybe we should have an ale and consider our camping options, such as across in the marshes on the other side of the canal.
But no, I'm a stickler for crashing on these things. I have to say, I go camping a lot with a friend called Carl, quite often walking rather than cycling. And because most of the camping we do is wild camping, we have this thing by which he's always going, looking at his watch and saying, oh, it's getting a bit dark, maybe here would be good. And I'm forever saying, oh, no, I'm sure we can find a better spot. Let's move on. Let's push on until we find something better. And usually, I'd say four times out of five, it's okay. But it's the fifth time out of five when it goes horribly wrong. It's pitch black. We can't find anywhere. And it's all very miserable. But, you know, it's all part of the game. That, of course, will not happen to us tonight because we've already had our tragedies. Hang on, I'll say that again. We've already had our
misfortunes.
I couldn't think of the word. I could only think of the word misfits.
Well, I think it probably does work quite accurately. Three misfits on the bumble, Midsummer Madness. Well, we've made it to what is going to be our home for the night. And Dixie, you're going to provide the word picture to describe this little spot of ours.
Okie doke. Well, we seem to be a little way to the west of the canal. We can't actually see the canal. There's some trees, a few hawthorns around us. We're in a little space in between a wooden fence and what is presumably a body of water. Across us on one side there's a field dominated, I think that's probably the word, by huge electricity pylons. But they almost look, I wouldn't say magical exactly, but there's a certain something to them with the night sky. You can see the sunset, what was the sunset across the other side of what looked like poplars over there. And we've got some fairly flat ground. It's quite high grass and it's almost meadow-like. I think in the morning we'll probably appreciate it.
I'm looking at the enormous electricity pylons, but I'm thinking that if I transport my imagination to the Nevada desert and imagine that we are at the Burning Man Festival and this is actually a huge sculpture that's just been erected in the desert for purposes that we will discover during the night, then it all becomes much more exciting as a proposition.
It certainly does. Outer London as Nevada. I think you've probably hit the nail on the head there. As we were coming up the canal, I thought desert mainly. That's what it said to me, desert.
I felt my lowest ebb as we got diverted off the towpath through an area that was used primarily for fly tipping, and then there was a graveyard, and then there was a bunch of dodgy looking warehouses, and then there was some sort of dual carriageway.
Yeah, it's not really why you go cycling or camping, but it was nice to have gone through there because we appreciate where we are now all the more.
Now Dixie is constructed out of a handful of flat pieces of metal. What looks like some kind of stove. What's this?
This is a honey stove made by some chap somewhere in Britain who designs all his own outdoor equipment. It's very good. Basically, six pieces of, I think it's aluminium or stainless steel or something. You slot them all together, and if you've got some twigs that are dry, that kind of thing, you can pop them in there. And you've got your stove ready for cooking. I'm cheating today, so I'm putting it in a different little format. Just four of the sides, slot them together, put a trancher in. I'm about to fill it with a bit of mess, and we're going to get some cooking going.
So what's on the menu?
Well, we've got... I've done a bit of cheating here. I've got some new potatoes, which I have already cooked, which we can just eat there. They've got a bit of dressing on and that kind of thing. I've got some couscous, and I've got a bit of pasta here that we're going to have with tomato and something like that. So I'll probably make the pasta. We can eat that with the potatoes, and I'll cook up the couscous while we're doing that, and that will form the basis of the meal.
So carbohydrate heavy. Yeah. Three forms of carbohydrate.
You know what? I hadn't thought of that. I was quite busy today. And I didn't give much thought to the food. But you're right, there is a bit of... Well, look, Lots of tomato in there, so at least that's not carbo.
Oh, and I brought some cashew nuts.
Yes, in case we haven't got quite enough.
I've been drinking water out of Harlow. I've been drinking water out of Harlow. I can't be a kid now.
It's about 6:30 in the morning. I've just woken up. There was a pretty wild dawn chorus a couple of hours ago. I seem to enter my dreamlike state. But now the birds have quietened down somewhat, and the predominant sound seems to be the M25 away in the distance as the morning rush hour gets going. Slept pretty well, although not the longest night's sleep, but it was the shortest night of the year, and we didn't get off to bed until some time after midnight, so I guess that's to be expected. Bikes are still here. I'm going to see what stirs with the other two chaps. Nothing, they seem to be out for the count.
Let anybody one thing, honey, ever grieve my mind.
Well, there appears to be some movement from my companions. In fact, Dixie's getting the tea on. Now that we have the light of the new day and the nights are drawing in, it's downhill all the way to Christmas. What do you think of our spot? Seeing it in a whole new light?
Well, actually, literally, yeah, I have to say. Yeah, it's quite nice. We've got some hawthorns there about, which...
They were about last night.
They were about.
And you did comment upon them.
I did, rather. But it's nice to see them in their full glory. It's a pity they're not here in May, because they'd have all been out. But
there's a few cows in an adjacent field.
Oh, there's a bloke. There's a bloke, an actual living, breathing human being walking.
That'll be the first of the dog walkers.
I suspect,
the dog walkers are the curse of the wild camper in the urban, peri-urban fringe. it's where you find... you've been discovered at very early hours of the morning, where people insist on going out to walk their dogs. Although, a couple of dogs. There we go, there he is. Man in a black tracksuit with a couple of black Labradors. I saw a cormorant fly over about 10 minutes ago. And last night we spotted a heron, or went right past a heron on the banks of the canal, or was it the river?
Canal.
I thought I'd seen some fireflies or glowworms before I realised they were just normal flies illuminated by the very bright light on the front of Simon's bicycle. What else did we see? It feels like we saw some sheep. Yeah, we smelled the sheep. We smelt the sheep before we saw them, but we did see them grazing on the banks of the reservoir. Not everybody can wild camp all the time, though we may try, and sometimes one would want to sleep in a campsite. And you've written the book Tiny Campsites, which kind of explains itself a little bit in the title, but would you care to elaborate?
Yes, it's 75 of my favourite tiny campsites. By tiny, I mean an acre or under. Most of them are considerably under an acre. In fact, the smallest one, you can just about fit 4 small tents on. But it came about because I was cycling around
in Devon one year on Dartmoor. Saw a campsite on my map, thought, right, it's dusk coming on, better go and camp. Turned up at it, it was a horrible commercial site. It was like a glorified car park. And my little heart sank into my boots. I thought, oh, well, I suppose I've just got to suck it up. Not that we use that phrase in those days. And then I saw a little sign on a tree, a handwritten sign that had been tacked up onto a tree that just said camping with an arrow. I thought, okay, I'll follow that instead. And 10 minutes later, I was putting my tent up in somebody's back garden. And I thought, you know, this is so much nicer than a great big campsite. So I went around looking for a book that would show me where all these nice tiny campsites were. And it didn't exist. So I thought, oh, well, I have to write it myself. So I wrote it really for all the people who, like me, turn up at a campsite and go, it's so big and it's so horrible. There's so much tarmac everywhere and huge, great buildings and blah. But actually just want a really nice little campsite. Some of them have got nice facilities. Some are a bit more rough and ready. And the great thing is, most of them are a lot cheaper than if you go to the big ones as well. So you're saving money as well. In these straitened times, you've got to think of that.
And how many campsites did you visit on your travels by bicycle? We should remind the world, you researched this book entirely by train and bike. How many did you visit to get your 75 that feature in the book?
Oh, lorks. Would have been towards a couple of hundred, I guess. I narrowed my search down a lot at home on the internet and whatever, checking things out, making sure that campsites were under an acre. Got my short list down to somewhere between 150 and 200, and then banged them out. And if I turned up, didn't like it, didn't go in the book.
And were there any that were so nice and so tiny and so pure that you thought, I'm just going to keep this one to myself?
That was such a temptation with two or three of them. I thought, I really don't want it to go in. But then, you know, good self overcame evil self and they went in the book. So, yeah, everything that I like is in there.
Can you pick out three top tiny campsites, your three best ones? Or not necessarily your three favourite ones, but three really interesting ones that you think are definitely worth a visit?
Yeah, I'd go for Broadmeadow House, which is down in Charlestown in Cornwall near St Austell. Just fantastic. Tiny field. They only allow 10 people maximum in it. You've got a cracking view of the sea, the cliffs, and a couple of amazing great old clipper ships that stay down in the harbour. Then there, I would go for Middle Ninver Farm, which is just outside Abergavenny. Again, fantastic little place. They've got a croquet lawn at the bottom, and there are a couple of pitches next to that. And you can play croquet if you like. Then you climb up the hill at the back, and they've got three tiny, almost like wild pitches that you can go up to. And they have amazing views of the Usk Valley. They've got a couple of friendly horses that come round to see you in the morning, if you're lucky, and a nice cat who will come and say hello. And it's just a beautiful, quiet spot. It feels like wild camping, basically. And a third, I'd probably go up to Scotland and go to Badralach, which is on the west coast of Scotland, up a long, long road, which is fantastic for cycling on. There's almost no cars at all. And right at the end of the road, there's this little campsite overlooking a sea loch. And from there, you can walk along a peninsula to an isolated community there, which doesn't have a road going out to it at all. It's amazing. They get around by boat the whole time. And it's slightly hippie-ish. And it's just a really beautiful, quiet place to be. There's a bunkhouse there as well. So if it pours with rain the whole time you're there, at least you can sit in the bunkhouse and make yourself some tea.
And are there any tiny campsites that are only accessible by foot or by bicycle? Or are they all car accessible, theoretically? Not that we would be going by car.
Right. No, of course not. Well, again, one of my favourite ones is Peel Island, which is off Barrow in Furness. And you can, there are no cars that can get there. You can walk across at low tide from another island called Walney Island, or you can take the boat, which most people do. There's a sort of informal boat service that flips across from the mainland. And that's wonderful, because there's nothing on Peel Island except a pub, a castle, and three houses. And the amazing thing about it is that you can camp anywhere on the island if you want to. I mean, I camped inside the outer bailey of the castle because it was quite windy, and I thought, oh, get out of the wind here. And you wake up and you think, I'm in a castle. It's brilliant. So, yeah, again, that would have to be one of my favourites as well.
That was a Midsummer Misadventure with me and Dixie Wills, whose excellent book Tiny Campsites is published by Punk Publishing, and I think it's available for a tenner in your local bookshop or online. I think you can buy it from tinycampsites.co.uk. He's also the author of the excellent Z to Z of Britain and the even better Places to Hide, and you can also look out for him in The Guardian. Coming up to the end of the show, but a very important announcement. It is here, after 7 years of broadcasting, The Bike Show has its own jersey, and you can buy that jersey. You can be one of a small handful of people who are going to be able to buy that jersey. And you don't have to take my word for it being a beautiful artefact. I have Chris Dixon, who is the presenter of Café Calcio, a football programme on Resonance FM, in the studio. You're taking a look at the... See, he's also a cyclist.
Oh, I am also a cyclist, yes.
So what do you reckon?
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's orange. Some people who may or may not know me will know me as a redhead, so I'm not sure how well that will work with
it's
me.
It's going to be beautiful.
But it's set off with black, and it's a very, very pretty item.
It's
indeed.
Sometimes difficult to wear orange. That's why we put the black shoulders in there, to create that kind of break from the for the redheads out there. It's designed by Richard Mitchelson, who did the logo, and the logo of The Bike Show, which you'll see on the website, features on the front, leaning on a lamppost, which is where the zip is, and on the back, I think the back is the best bit, is this sort of M.C. Escher-inspired flock of London pigeons, or a flight of London pigeons. I think that's the correct collective noun for London pigeons. It's £70, but it's going to be made out of the most technical of sporting fabrics.
I could do with one now, actually. It's quite sweaty in here, isn't it, really?
Yeah,
if I could have something that would take that away from my skin.
Well, it's going to be extremely high wicking material and made to the very best standards, made in the EU, in Slovakia, and yeah, made by Miltag, who are sticklers for detail, and all their stuff is really beautifully designed.
Just sign up for one now.
So we are taking pre-orders until the first day of the Tour de France, or the first weekend of the Tour de France, the 3rd of July. So you can get your pre-order in now. They will not be available afterwards. This is it, folks. This is the time to have, well, definitely the first and probably the last piece of Bike Show merchandising. And it is really distinctive. And the main thing to remember about orange...
You'll be seen.
You'll be seen, but you'll also climb faster. Think about it. Think about it. It's the Euskaltel team. It's Eddy Merckx in his Molteni orange. It's Jacques Anquetil and Luis Ocaña.
Of course.
For the BIC team. I mean, orange has a fine pedigree amongst climbers.
So this effectively adds about 3% to your power, increasing your power to weight ratio.
At least. You can find out all about it on The Bike Show's webpage, www.thebikeshow.net. Thanks for listening. Next up is the new season 7 of One Life Left. Hey there, podcast listeners. This is Ira Glass. Well, no, it's not Ira. It's Jack again. I'm back. Thanks for listening to the radio show, but I don't think we quite got enough time in the half hour to do justice to the excellent Bike Show jersey, which is available for pre-order now. And I want to run through a few reasons why I really do think you should buy the jersey. And after that, by way of a reward, we will have an extra 20 minutes or so of Podmax only available content for podcast listeners as a way of keeping you sticking around through this commercial break, although it's not really commercial because I'm not really making any money out of the jersey. But these are my five reasons why I think you should buy the jersey. The first is, of course, that it's a beautiful design. Richard Mitchelson and Ed at Miltag have done themselves proud, transforming the logo of Bike Show, the kind of front-on silhouette of a bicycle, which features on the front of the jersey, and of course the pigeons, which are the highlight of the back of the jersey, into a really nice design. And there are a lot of details there as well. There's the nod to the Renault jerseys of the 1970s and 1980s, worn by Laurent Fignon. There's a bunch of other detailing, and the whole thing is top quality, and that's the second reason why you should buy it. It's not just a piece of fun, and for 70 quid, which is what it costs, it shouldn't be. It's really good quality material, high wicking, high performance, so good for those summer days. And if you order it now, we should be able to get the production done in time for August, for summer holidays. It will have a full-length zip and three pockets at the back. And the material, yeah, I think it's something called Cool Plus or something like that. I think we might be using the same material that ASOS use for their high-performance jerseys. The jersey will be made in the EU, in Slovakia, to be precise. It'll be a very small production run, which means that the quality will be able to be maintained and observed on every single jersey. So we'll make sure that everyone is perfect. By wearing a Bike Show jersey, of course, you'll be helping to spread the word about the show and get some more listeners, which is what I want and hopefully what you want if you enjoy listening to the show. And wearing a jersey will give you a chance to tell people about it, I hope. It'll also identify yourself to other people who listen to the show as a Bike Show listener, and who knows where that will lead. And fifthly, buying one of these jerseys will help support Resonance FM financially. Ed at Miltag has promised that a share of the proceeds will go to Resonance. I don't know what that'll be, but hopefully if we get the production run that we're looking for, the costs will work out in such a way that £10 per jersey will be able to go to Resonance FM to keep the station going. So five reasons why this is a great jersey. Please order it now. You can find out more going to thebikeshow.net. It's there to look at, and the jerseys will be with us in August. So thanks for sticking with me through that. It was as difficult for me as it was for you. I hate selling things. But seeing as we've got this thing being made, let's try and get a few out there. So now let's have the last bit of the show. And this is a talk given by Andrew Nether, who is a bigwig at the Evening Standard. I think he's currently associate editor or editor of the comment section. Anyway, he gave a talk at a seminar organised by the CTC, bringing together a bunch of people from around Europe who are interested in looking at what London has been doing for cycling recently. And the subject of his talk was how the Evening Standard's attitude towards cycling had changed. You may remember, if you're a long-time listener to the show, a show we did in May 2007 where Buffalo Bill Chidley and I sat in my back garden and looked shocked and delighted at the Evening Standard of that day, which carried a front page campaigning for cycling, campaigning for reducing road danger, and carried through into the interior of the paper with some 12-point cycling charter. Anyway, that moment was the marker of a real change in attitude by the Evening Standard, and Andrew Nether explains why.
Okay, this is a defiantly low-tech presentation here. Thanks, Adam. I really don't want to take the credit either for the paper or for me for changing attitudes in London that much, because you know the Standard has been a part of a really quite significant shift in attitudes to cycling and in cycling's profile in this city over the last decade or so. I would say, and is, you know, there have been fairly steadily increasing numbers of cyclists. I think it's really a story about sort of normalisation of cycling. There have always been hardcore cyclists out in Lycra and so on. I'm one of them, where I am now, out there cycling and agitating for better provision for cyclists and so on. What's really changed is the way the cycling has become just a very ordinary way to get around in terms of commuting. Now, I mean, I would argue that, we're not there yet. I mean, it was interesting. I was in Amsterdam a couple of weeks ago, and you really saw the contrast there. I mean, I've been cycling in London now for about nearly seven years. It's noticeable how many more cyclists there are. When you're at a junction, the number of cyclists sort of bunched up at the front of the traffic. But I mean, compared to Amsterdam, it's a completely different story. One of the things which, to a London cyclist, is most striking about Amsterdam is the way that hardly anyone wears a helmet. In fact, I don't think I saw anyone wearing a helmet, or Lycra, or reflectives, or any of the other things which are just completely normal for cyclists in London. And that reflects, I mean, there's obviously, this being Holland, it's a different culture. But in terms of the normalising cycling, you not having to be a road warrior to go out there and get to work on your bike, that's at least what I am interested in moving cycling towards in London. Because if for no other reason, when people like my wife finally start cycling to work, it's a question of numbers and it's a question of safety as well. I would say in that time, as part of this sort of narrative I'm attempting to give you the last decade or so, my sense, just personally, is that the cycling has become safer as well. I can't remember what the overall movement in accident numbers is, but I think the deaths are down over that time. Certainly, my sense is that I have fewer near misses than I did 5-6 years ago when I started. I think London drivers have become more used to cyclists, even if the roads are still primarily there for cars, I would say. And in terms of how that change has occurred, well, it's obviously gradual. I would point to particular events or particular projects that push things along particularly, and which obviously from the point of view of the media are particularly interesting. I mean, one of the really noticeable times when it changed was during the bombings on the tube in 2005. I mean, I would identify that as a real point at which things changed. And of course, some of those people who started cycling that July into work because they were scared of the tube, sure, they go back to the tube the following week or the week after, but some of them don't. And I would just give my own experience here. I started cycling in London. I hadn't got on a bike for about 10 years and I'd never cycled in a big city before I started in 2004, and I did it because of a tube strike. And As luck would have it, I'd been offered a bike to road test for some odd reason, as you tend to be on features desks. And, so I tried it for a week and never looked back, basically. The other big event is what Abby has been talking about with the cycle hire scheme. And that, to me, it's almost as important about the cycle hire scheme as having a good system that people can use easily. It also normalises cycling. These are bikes which you've tried them. I mean, in terms of their design, they're very much intended for casual users, for people who aren't kitted out in cycling shoes and Lycra and so on. And it just makes cycling just a more completely normal choice in terms of getting around. And I think it's almost that sort of demonstration effect, which maybe 3 or 4 years down the line we'll be able to see in terms of the stats that kicking in. I mean, in terms of the and you know, I mean, there's all sorts of other sort of symbolic things. I mean, I think the fact that we have a mayor who cycles. I mean, the previous mayor was pretty good on cycling as well, but I think that, you know, we have a famously cycling mayor. I think that's quite a positive little thing. I mean, in terms of the way that we cover cycling stories, we've given more prominence over the past few years to cycling stories than we once did. It's partly because I'm a senior executive on the paper and I keep banging on about cycling and getting us and writing things myself. But it also reflects, I mean, it's just tied up with this greater move towards cycling. There are actually lots of members of the paper staff who cycle to work, including some other senior execs. Our managing director is a very keen cyclist, the features editor. That helps a lot. And it helps in terms of, again, I keep coming back to this idea of sort of normalisation. I think you need people coming into cycling fresh to cycling in a big city in order maybe to make it seem more approachable to other people who haven't got into cycling yet, because it's very easy to forget when you're an experienced cyclist, urban cyclist, you just get on with it and you know. But I remember, for instance, when I first got on a bike in London, it seems completely obvious, right? But I was really amazed at how great your all-round visibility was and how, you know, it actually didn't feel dangerous. Well, you know, sure, you know that, but, you know, my wife, for instance, doesn't know that because she hasn't tried it. And the same is true for a lot of people who are non-cyclists, some of whom are drivers in London or occasional drivers. You have a sense of, you know, of protection in a car that you don't on a bike, but a bike actually feels perfectly safe. And in terms of the kind of things that we've covered, I mean, obviously something like in the past year, the cycle hire scheme has been very important. I mean, we've certainly worked consciously to sort of create a sense of anticipation for that, if you like, partly because I've always felt very optimistic about the cycle hire scheme and how it would take off. So, for instance, in January of last year, we had a sort of cycling series to kick off the year, why 2010 was going to be a big year for cycling in London. The biggest single development, obviously, being the hire scheme, but the superhighways as well. I went over to Paris and sort of tested the scheme there. I road tested one of the new bikes. We had, you know, a range of other features. I mean, there's, other things like we've done sort of, you know, over the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, things like, for instance, you know, cycling kit, cycling clothing. You know, again, it's the general phenomenon, but it's sort of broken out of the ghetto of lycra-clad cyclists. And it's something which, you know, more people are going to consider cool now. And so it's a sort of regular thing we do in terms of recommending kit and clothing, just as you would for other sorts of products in a features section of a newspaper. In terms of our coverage of news, I think we probably give much greater prominence to cycling safety issues. And, I mean, we've had some disagreements with TfL over this. I mean, in terms of our coverage of fatal accidents, you know, of which are regular in London, they're not vast. I can't remember, last year was it 8 or 9, something like that? I can't remember the figure. But, I mean, and many of them involved in many of them killed by lorries, often left-turning lorries. You know, our concern as a newspaper is, just as cycling becomes more prominent, more visible in the city, you know, it's important to cover an important cycling issue like that. But at the same time, we're conscious, I'm conscious, that I don't want to exaggerate the dangers. I don't want to, you know, make people think they're going to die if they cycle to work, because, you know, you're almost certainly not, you know. So I hope we've struck a balance there. I mean, again, it's, Adam mentioned the fact, you know, we're a newspaper, you know, we're journalists, we're ultimately critical when we think we need to be critical. We're not campaigners. So, you know, there was at least one occasion on which the, you know, TfL got cross with us because they said we were overemphasizing accidents, but you know, it's news, and you know, we cover news. You know, similarly, if there were a problem with the cycle hire scheme, yes, we would cover it, and you know, and if TfL were embarrassed, well, that's tough, but that's just what we do. I mean, we have at various points over the past 3 or 4 years done some sort of more campaign-y things. I mean, in 2007, we launched a 12-point cycling charter for London, which was really a... I mean, it was sort of in consultation with, you know, with cyclists and with the London Cycling Campaign and so on, making demands for things like, you know, better cycle networks and cycle routes, better parking, training, more action on this issue around safety with lorries in particular. I think that it's probably helpful to cycling in London to do that. It helps raise awareness of those issues. It's ultimately quite hard for any media outlet to run a campaign like that over any length of time. I mean, for me, the basic rules of any newspaper campaign are you pick sort of achievable targets, you get to them as soon as you can, and then you declare victory and attempt to take the credit. And you know, we didn't do that over the cycling charter, but cycling in a big city like London is a complicated enough subject that it's actually quite hard to campaign on in an organised way through any media outlet. That's one of the challenges for any media outlet which is trying to support cycling. I mean, there's a basic problem in terms of we have to find news, and you have to, or in a features section, you have to find new angles, and a lot of the things. Issues in cycling don't change that much from week to week. I mean, this is our stock in trade, coming up with new angles on familiar subjects, but it's not always easy. The other thing I'd say about a lot of cycling issues is that they're quite techie, they're quite crunchy. I mean, they're key issues, and things like permeability, for instance, and if you like the sort of attractiveness and importance of little schemes like permeability, like being able to go both ways on certain one-way streets, or you can have a contra-flow bike lane, or you can allowing access sort of through an area where there once were railings, things like that. I mean, I know Hackney have been particularly good in addressing that. And a lot of these are great things to do. A lot of them aren't actually that expensive in terms of, you know, digging up little bits of road or taking out bits of railings or changing road markings. They're not very sexy. It's quite hard to to make news stories out of that. And it's the kind of thing which those are the kind of measures which, I mean, on my pages, on the comment pages, I can sweep up some of that stuff and talk about it in an interesting way. But it's quite hard to do without sounding like a cycling nerd a lot of the time, I think. Goodness knows we'd want to avoid that. And, you know, aside from that, there's just the usual sorts of challenge on any newspaper in what are just fantastically competitive, challenging times with things like resources. I mean, for instance, we had a cycling section of the website for a while, and the idea was we would have people, essentially cycling members of staff, blogging on it regularly, and it's essentially just we're too stretched in terms of resources and in terms of what people have got to do in order to do it. So that's one part of our cycling coverage which is sort of faded into the background for the moment, not forever, I hope. I guess the other thing I'd say in terms of profile and in terms of what's news, there's a bit of a contrast between central London and the boroughs, or particularly the outer boroughs. And it obviously this applies particularly to somewhere as geographically big as London, which is such a big city. I mean, it's very important that there are measures to improve cycling routes and all of the rest of it and parking and all the issues out in the boroughs. And that's often where it's hardest in terms of persuading boroughs, and particularly ones which are more car-oriented, to change things. But it's actually quite hard for a paper like us to write about it, because it always seems very local. So if, you know, say, for instance, I mean, Barnet, for instance, have done various sort of, anti-cycling, very pro-driver measures. It always, you know, you just see Barnet, and, you know, if you don't live in Barnet, you don't care, basically. I mean, I've never even been to Barnet. I mean, I'm sure it's delightful. But, I live in South London, and it's a problem with any local stories. A very local story which doesn't really have any immediate relevance elsewhere, it has to be quite dramatic to get into the Standard. And that's just news. We've got, you know, enormous pressure on news pages, and, you know, propose a story about cycling in Barnet, well, you know, it's probably not going to make the cut. As I said at the start, I'm really not claiming credit for the Standard for what's happened. I do think that any media outlet obviously has a duty to, you know, to report what's going on out there, and there has been a really significant change in cycling and in attitudes to cycling, I think, in London over the last 10 years. We're not there yet. I mean, it always shocks me slightly whenever I write something about cycling, or I commission somebody else to write on my pages, comment pages about cycling. You can see on the website the most incredibly hostile comments. There's something about cycling which really sets off a certain kind of driver. And, you know, we're not talking about vast numbers, but it's, you know, there are a load of people out there who basically really hate cyclists, actually. And I think they're a fairly small minority, but they are still out there. But as I said, I think that's getting less and less, and especially with things like the cycle hire scheme, it will continue to do so, I hope.
Thanks for listening to this extended podcast edition of the show. Tune in to the radio show next week, Monday, 6:30 p.m. or sometime shortly thereafter on the podcast. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.